Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Hi, I'm Debbie Brock, founder of Homeopathy World Community, speaking with our co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law. Today is February 17th, 2011. I want to thank you to all our hundreds of listeners. We have so many options on Blog Talk Radio to friend, to follow, to get all your shows on the RSS feed, and to upload that widget of the radio show to your very own website. You can share our shows by having a conversation on Twitter and posting links on Facebook. And you can join us live right now on the chat to post your comments and questions and ask Alan what are your concerns. You can also favorite the show and download it to your iPod, iTunes, or computer. Today, for some reason, my headset is not working, and I'm just talking directly into the computer, into the interface there, and I'm hoping that my sound level is okay. Let me know if I need to make a change to increase or decrease it. And Alan, are you there?
I am, Debbie, and you sound fine on this end.
Great, because I'm not getting a perfect sound coming into me, but as long as everybody can hear, that's what's important. And today I thought I would start out with something a little bit different. You know, we're on all of these social networks, and that's how we collaborate and learn about each other and encourage and support each other. And today I saw a little video called Beyond Civilization by Daniel Quinn. It was posted by Lee Horvatic on Facebook. And it's really an incredible, stimulating little short video about life. And I kind of looked up who is Daniel Quinn. And if this is the exact person who has created this video, it is. He was born in 1935 in Nebraska and is an American writer described as an environmentalist, best known for his book called Ishmael, written in 1992, which won the Turner Tomorrow Fellowship Award in 1991. So Quinn himself does not identify himself as an environmentalist, pointing out that the term evokes the notion of something that is out there and somehow not us. The typical conception of environmentalism, Quinn argues, is one of a false dichotomy, a false division that says that there's the environment and then there's us humans living in the environment and somehow not a part of it. And that's kind of an interesting concept. So I wanted to say what Lee has written about that particular little video that is so thought-provoking. She says, "Oh, I think that many of us are evolving slowly in a different direction already, one that is becoming something akin to a huge global tribe, with much more empathy towards one another, towards others, and toward the environment, less constricted by imposed borders and imagined differences, and overall much more self-empowered, thus being able to share our observations and help others see themselves equally empowered. As Daniel Quinn says, there's a huge resistance coming from the few that hold the power, but their power seems to be becoming more and more transparent to the big number of individuals and slowly losing its grip. After all, their draconian attempts to block the HAM, complementary and alternative medicine, and homeopathy from reaching further and more people is one of the illustrations of desperate throes they are in. I think change is going to reveal itself, perhaps in the generations to come. Knowledge is our power. No one can rule or govern us if we feel strong and capable enough to govern and rule ourselves. And this then translates into self-management of such things as building and maintenance of roads, hospitals, and supply of electricity. When time comes, we shall not feel we need others to manage for us, but appoint responsibility in groups who are responsibly overlooking such needs, while the rest of us continue to contribute responsibly with the qualities that we have to offer. Evolution is happening. I know that's a big mouthful to start the session off, but I thought it was so important, and it's part of what we are doing together, why we're on the network, on the radio show, having these conversations, and pushing forth the agenda of health freedom. Alan.
I agree.
I know I surprised you with that.
Yep. Well, it goes to just the sort of the fundamental issue about freedom of choice and who should have freedom of choice and when and what information is available and how. And, of course, those are all enormous issues, ongoing questions and ongoing issues. But I think the starting point is that we have to inform ourselves about the available choices. And then if we have a preferred choice that is not available to us for whatever reason, you know, insurance policies seldom cover homeopathy and some of the, at least here in the U.S., less widely available or widely known so-called alternative and complementary healthcare options. And so the first step, of course, is to educate oneself about what the options are. The second step is to avail yourself of those options if that's what you choose. And if you're not able to do that, and of course that goes to the heart of the whole vaccine controversy about whether or not people have a choice to refuse vaccines or to choose homeoprophylaxis or other means of dealing with infectious disease, then we need to become legislatively active. And there is a lot going on in the last few days legislatively on the vaccine front around the country. And we'll talk about some of that today, as well as picking up where we left off last week about the what I have come to conclude is not merely a justifiable basis for philosophical exemptions, but I believe that there is a moral and ethical imperative that we offer freedom of choice philosophical exemptions everywhere that vaccines are mandated.
Okay, so let's just do like a little summary of what we did last week. We talked about House Bill number 416, that's in New Hampshire, and about adding an exemption from immunizations for conscientious beliefs. And it appears that there are many valid reasons why parents would decline or make a choice not to vaccinate. It is coming to light that the science to support vaccinations is not there. More and more of these physicians who are right there in the field working with individuals are starting to testify to what they are seeing in their patients. Testing has not actually been done thoroughly and properly for safeguarding the vaccinated. I just heard a recent talk, and the physician was saying, it was Len Zaputo, MD, and he was speaking on swine flu vaccines and protecting your well-being. He was a graduate of Duke University Medical School and is board certified in internal medicine. He says that we're not really spending the time to provide the accurate information about the efficacy and safety of these vaccines. So that was something coming to light, and that most people who succumbed to an epidemic of influenza in particular were already weakened with immune deficiency diseases, respiratory ailments, and other health problems. These persons, including the very old or the very young, cannot even tolerate vaccinations. So we have numerous experts and medical physicians speaking out. I encourage people to listen to the recent video and read her blogs, Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, a nephrologist, who tells us the dangers to kidney health regarding vaccinations. So I want to thank you, Alan, for submitting this affidavit to the New Hampshire senators and representatives, and we have 9 points to go over. We went over the first three, and we're up to point number four, that mandatory vaccination denies citizens the right to choose proven, safer, more effective alternatives.
Well, I thought I'd make a couple preliminary comments, if I may, Debbie, before we dive into that fourth point. One is that there are currently bills pending in Washington State and New Jersey to restrict access to exemptions. And I expect if we start off on point four, we won't have time to talk about those in today's show. So I thought I'd make a quick mention of them because they are current topics.
Do you want to go ahead and talk about them?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll do that real briefly if I may. The bill in Washington State would require that forms for all exemptions, medical, religious, or philosophical, and they have all three of them there, include a statement signed by a healthcare practitioner that the parent or guardian has been informed of the benefits and risks of the immunization. I mean, that kind of fails the common sense test. It's really not appropriate to make doctors gatekeepers for non-medical exemptions. But I think the problems with that bill go even further. I think that bill, proposed bill, is unconstitutional. It would not pass constitutional scrutiny. And so, and I have written about both of these bills. The information is posted on the vaccinerights.com website. And people are welcome to email me, attorney@vaccinerights.com about this or any other pending legislation for or against concerning vaccine rights. But we federal courts have addressed the issue in question of what it takes to qualify for a vaccine religious exemption. And in terms of the federal First Amendment right, the part of the First Amendment that has what's called the Free Exercise Clause that refers to the free exercise of religion, what does it take to have federal First Amendment protection? And you really only have to have two things for vaccine religious exemption. You have to have beliefs that are religious and that are sincerely held. And what Washington State is trying to do is to add yet another criteria for the exercise of the exemption, and I believe that is contrary to these federal court cases that have said First Amendment only requires two things, that you have sincerely beliefs that are sincere, sincerely held, and religious. So I believe the folks in Washington who oppose this restrictions on rights, and you know, on a practical level, it really doesn't make sense. You're going to have doctors trying to explain the risks and benefits of immunizations to people whose religious objections, that information is irrelevant certainly could be irrelevant to a religious objection. And so it's really an attempt by the state to talk people out of religious exemptions and philosophical exemptions, basically to control. And it's understandable from their point of view because exemptions have been and continue to be, on the whole, increasing. And, you know, we as a society need to take a look at what that means beyond the sort of mainstream knee-jerk reaction of, oh my gosh, we're all at risk because more people are opting out of immunizations. And we talked about that some last week, and I'll summarize again in a couple minutes today, that thinking is fear-based and not really rational or defensible in a rational, reasonable way. But anyway, we have that going on in Washington State, and let me skip on over to the New Jersey bill then in the interest of time. Currently in New Jersey, you only need to provide a signed written statement stating that the vaccines interfere with the free exercise of your religion. And what this new proposed law in New Jersey would do would be to require people to exercise an exemption to write a statement explaining how the vaccines conflict with the religious tenets or practices. And there's several issues here. Just that phrase, tenets or practices, heavily implies organized religion. You really don't have a tenet or a practice. You don't have a tenet without an organized religion. But the problem there is that under the Constitution and under federal legal precedent, it doesn't matter whether or not you belong to an organized religion or which one you belong to if you do. So this bill would prohibit people who have a genuine religious belief that is violated, but maybe not a tenet or practice. Maybe somebody is Buddhist or Catholic, religions that don't have a tenet that is opposed to immunization, but their interpretation of their belief is that of their religion is that immunizations violate their religious beliefs, and again we have legal precedent saying that all you have to have is the a belief that's religious and that is sincerely held. And so the current wording of the New Jersey bill, in my opinion, is unconstitutional, violates the Constitution. We have federal court cases that say that that phrasing is going too far. But even if they were to correct the language, because the bottom line is I think the Constitution does not prevent the state from scrutinizing religious exemptions. Some states have laws that allow the state to do that. Some states have laws that don't allow the state to scrutinize religious exemption claims. Well, every state has a mainstream view on vaccines in terms of the current laws enacted. And so why would a state not give itself the authority to scrutinize religious exemption claims if it could? Well, the answer to that, I believe, is because there is only so far that our government can go in terms of becoming entangled in religion. The separation of church and state is not an absolute black and white, red line that you can't cross over. There are situations where the state has authority to dip somewhat into an exploration or assessment or analysis of religion. And the vaccine issue is a real good example of that in terms of vaccine religious beliefs. But the problem here is that if you have local officials who are going to be assessing and analyzing people's religious beliefs to see whether or not they qualify for vaccine religious exemption, you're going to have a problem here, perhaps on more than one level. We have a U.S. Supreme Court case from a few years back that set out a test for when does the government cross over the line and have excessive entanglement in religion. And I think we have the possibility for that when you have a law that allows the state to scrutinize religious exemption claims. But you have the problem when you have local authorities who are doing this assessing that they're going to be applying different standards in different parts of the state, or possibly the same standard, but applying it differently. And that could lead to equal protection violations under the 14th Amendment. It certainly raises a question there. It raises a question about when and if the government does cross that line and get into excessive entanglement of government in religion. So that is probably the reason why there are many states that write their laws in such a way as they do not give the state authority to get in there and scrutinize vaccine religious exemption claims. But underlying all of this is the fact that if, you know, the states are concerned about having too many exempt people, and is that going to cause a problem for the health of the community? And the bottom line is all states have authority to either mandate vaccines in an emergency over and against people's religious objections, and or to quarantine citizens who are unvaccinated if there is a local outbreak or emergency. And so they have backup measures to deal with this. And so the state needn't be so concerned about trying to restrict people's ability to exercise a religious exemption, or even a philosophical exemption for that matter, even from the mainstream point of view. Now, let me reel myself in, Debbie, and get us back to the topic we started last week.
Right, mandatory vaccination denies citizens the right to choose proven, safer, more effective alternatives was the last point that we were leading up to. Just a follow-up, you said that in your last sentence, something about that, that the states have the ability to enforce certain mandatory quarantines or other things, emergency measures, when there is a pandemic or an epidemic, and that should cover the amount of power that they have, rather than getting into this little nitty-gritty things to micromanage. It sounds like too many things. In other words, making it too narrow a scope of language that's written, and making it more difficult for people to be able to exert their own rights, religious rights.
Yeah, well, in one sense, you know, there's even from the mainstream point of view, they're really, I think, overly concerned here, at least in the way they're trying to, as you say, micromanage. That's a good word for it. But when you look at these points we discussed last week, and we'll begin picking up on again shortly, concerning the arguments favoring a philosophical or conscientious objection, you realize that there's even less reason for these folks to be concerned in the way that they are, because the current policies are not built on the rock-solid foundation that the supporters of current policy claim that it is. When you look at it, when you scrutinize current policy, you realize it's got a vulnerable foundation in the sense that it's easy to attack. But I thought, for the benefit of any listeners who may not have been with us last week, I'd give a real quick summary of the points we've already discussed.
Good idea.
And the first one was that credit given to vaccines for 20th century childhood infectious disease decline is misplaced. On average, and it varies with the individual diseases, but on average, about 90% of infectious disease decline preceded vaccines. There were a number of diseases that declined without any vaccines at all: typhoid fever, scarlet fever, scurvy, tuberculosis, or just some of those. There was one particularly notable documented instance in which disease incidence and mortality increased following the introduction of vaccines, and that's with polio. And we mentioned that a Dr. Bernard Greenberg, head of the biostatistics department at the University of North Carolina, in 1962 testified before Congress that cases of polio increased substantially after polio vaccines were introduced, 50% from 57 to 58 and 80% from 1958 to 59, and that the Public Health Service deliberately manipulated statistics to give the opposite impression. In other words, the polio vaccine was a disaster that was covered up. We went on to talk about how a reliable risk-benefit assessment of vaccine and disease is really not feasible. And that's because we don't have precise mortality data from the diseases, and we use the recent swine flu pandemic as an example. The CDC estimated between 8,800 and 18,000 swine flu deaths here in the U.S. RISA Labs estimated 4,600 in the U.S. There are just going to be, in some cases, wildly different estimates from different sources. The bottom line there is we don't know. And there's a whole separate question that we didn't even get into about how do they define a flu-related death and what counts or doesn't count. But not only do we not know the disease mortality statistics, we don't know really anything about the scope and severity of vaccine injury and death. We know from the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System and the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program that vaccines do in fact cause permanent injury and death, but they are not adequate measures of the scope of the problem, because the FDA and CDC both have admitted that reported adverse events may represent as few as 1 to 10% of the events actually occurring. The point there is we don't know. We don't know disease mortality data with any precision. We don't know harm from the vaccines with any precision. And so there's a huge unknown there. We can't really calculate any sort of reasonable risk-benefit ratio, because there's not data available to really support any hard numbers on that. We then went on to talk about that the belief that unvaccinated persons pose a risk of harms to others is without merit. You know, we hear all the time that unvaccinated people put everyone else at risk. if vaccines work, then of course that's an absurd assertion. But there is an aspect of that concern that makes a little more sense, and that is the notion that the more intelligent pro-vaccine advocate will make, and they will say something more along the lines of, well, there are certain people for medical reasons who would like to be vaccinated but can't be vaccinated, and those people are put at risk by others who don't vaccinate. Well, but even that assumption is questionable, and for a couple of reasons. One, it assumes that the people who are not vaccinated are disease magnets, that somehow perhaps even in communities where there have been no outbreaks of some diseases for decades, somehow the status of being unvaccinated is going to start manifesting and creating diseases. I don't know of any information to suggest that there's any validity to that notion. If there is, I'd like to hear it. But perhaps more importantly is that the whole idea of that somebody who's not vaccinated by choice could be a risk to somebody who's not vaccinated by medical reason, you know, who would like to be vaccinated but can't be, is questionable, because that whole assertion rests on a belief in the herd immunity theory, which says you have to have most people vaccinated. In other words, even the ones who can't be vaccinated are going to be protected if everybody else gets vaccinated, because as long as most people are vaccinated, then the whole herd or community is vaccinated. And the problem with that theory is that there have been many, many studies that have shown and documented outbreaks in highly vaccinated populations, even one documented by the CDC of 100% vaccinated population had a disease outbreak. And we had a study looking at that with measles that came to the conclusion that as measles immunization rates rise to high levels, measles becomes a disease of immunized persons. I don't know how clearly you can state that. It's like our effort to maximize immunization rates may actually be counterproductive. And we saw that with the swine flu pandemic as well, that the a quick sampling in the countries that I looked at, the countries that had higher vaccination rates actually had higher death rates from the swine flu. And then Poland, who didn't vaccinate at all.
If we can get links to some of those statistics, that would be great. We have Dr. Bob in the chat room here. He says that at the university, North Carolina State University, they just sent out an email that there will be a free flu vaccine available to all of the faculty and students, and that there's a small epidemic going on campus right now. And when the student asked the university physician whether or not the vaccine covers strain A, which is the one that's on campus, the answer was no. So it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever to be injecting all of these people with these materials into their bloodstream, into their muscle tissue, and bypassing the normal mode of the vector for the disease, which people will probably get over and get a stronger immune system by having it. And what happens? So they're going to be giving these vaccinations to everyone with absolutely no reason if it doesn't even cover the strain. And that's one of the problems with developing vaccinations, influenza vaccinations specifically, because every year it's a new strain and it's a guess as to whether they're going to have that particular element in the vaccine that's developed.
Well, researchers are addressing that problem, actually. Debbie, they're working on a vaccine that would be a universal influenza vaccine. It addresses, I don't understand the science enough to be able to articulate it, but it aims at the problem from a different angle or perspective. There's an article on that posted on the, or linked from the PandemicResponseProject.com site's news page, and viewers can look for that there. But let's push on here to the to cover some new ground here, because we've covered a lot of the show with the Washington and New Jersey issues, and then just summing up what we covered last week. And this has to do with the idea that people keep framing the vaccine issue as what is safer, the vaccine or the disease, or which is riskier, the vaccine or the disease. And that's a valid question, but only up to a point, because it completely misses the point that there are other ways, possibly more effective, possibly safer, and even less expensive than vaccines for addressing infectious disease concerns. And I keep going back in all of my talks in recent months to talk about this Cuba incident, because it's just so dramatic. And of course, you know all about this, Debbie, that in the fall of 2008, Cuba used homeoprophylaxis to protect 2.5 million residents from a leptospirosis outbreak. That's a fever disease that they deal with down there frequently in connection with tropical flooding from the tropical storms and hurricanes that frequent that part of the world. And they had a protective effect that profoundly exceeded that of conventional immunizations. They had something on the order of about 10 infections and no deaths, whereas with immunizations, they typically have 1,000 or more infections and some number of deaths. And the cost using homeoprophylaxis, which is just using particular homeopathic remedies in the same function as immunizations, the cost was about 1/15. That of conventional immunization, and this was reportedly achieved with full scientific verification. It's not a study of 50 people where you wonder how it applies in the real world. They did this, they gave out 5 million doses to 2.5 million residents, two doses to each person, and the effects were dramatic. When you've got something that profound going on, if our health departments, state and federal health departments, were truly first and foremost concerned with what's most effective and safest and least expensive, and those certainly should be major guidelines that direct their focus, they would be jumping all and hopping all over the place trying to get research going to see, well, gee, how does this, you know, can we use this for other infectious diseases? And as I've mentioned before, for example, there was a recent Japanese study that found that vitamin D is better than vaccines at preventing flu. Well, recent vitamin D studies have shown that vitamin D deficiency correlates with a number of both acute and chronic diseases. There are, in many researchers' minds, we as a population are chronically vitamin D deficient. And there's research to suggest that not only will it prevent flu, but it may be preventative from other acute and chronic diseases. So vitamin D is something that's gotten a lot of attention in recent months and years and its effects on disease. But, you know, there's been a push to have schools around the country administer flu shots. Well, if they're really concerned about the flu, they should be administering vitamin D. It's more effective. It's a lot less expensive. You're not going to have disability and death from in fact, it's really difficult to overdose on vitamin D, and if you start showing any symptoms of overdose, it's a real quick fix. You stop taking it, you know, or lower your dosage. So it's a much more feasible approach to prevention of flu, but the more cynical of us point out that there are profound profit and perhaps other interests as well in continuing to promote the vaccine solution.
Alan, do you think that in this report that you've provided to the government officials there, that telling them about the leptospirosis success with the homeoprophylaxis and the vitamin D studies, do you think that this is new information to them? How do you think that they are going to receive this?
Well, I think the majority of them will, you know, when you're in the position of a state legislator, you're probably not so much going to try to be the one to decide which scientific argument is correct when there are disagreeing sides. The tendency, more often than not, is going to be to lean towards whatever your own state authorities or federal authorities say. So while I certainly hope I'm wrong, I don't have high expectations that there are going to be legislators reading this and trying to spearhead initiatives to do follow-up studies and further studies and look at this as a source. I hope I'm wrong. But I think the tendency, and I talk about this even much more so in the context of litigation, that, for example, specifically a court's job is not to decide who's right when people different sides disagree on the science. Their job is specifically to look at the weight of the evidence. And so when people talk about going into court and arguing about whether or not vaccines are safe, I don't think you can win that one in court. I think the truth is that the safety of vaccines is something profoundly different than what we are told by mainstream authorities. But despite that,
I think what I'm asking you is, what I'm asking you is, you know, the people who are reading all of this, number one, do they really get a chance to read it and absorb the information in depth, or do they just skim through it and not really let it sink in?
Well, I guess
they have so much to read every day. Can they really take the time to go through everything, like point by point, like we're doing? So that's
this,
one
yeah,
aspect.
This particular report went to a committee, and I think there were maybe something on the order of about 20 members. And, you know, it has yet to be seen what the result of that is. I mean, I certainly hope and support the idea, and I got a bit off on a tangent there, so thanks for reeling me back in. But I certainly hope that this will lead to education, awareness, and action based on that. But I don't think that's going to be a quick change. People who have not heard of homeopathy and whose medical authorities, you know, legislators, whose state medical people are saying homeopathy doesn't work, or we don't have any research to back that up, or, you know, anything else that would be ultimately either a personal bias or politically based put down, that's hard to overcome. But as it comes up more and more and over again, and more constituents are saying, no, wait, you do need to listen to this regardless of what mainstream folks are saying. You know, I'm firm in my personal commitment to homeoprophylaxis as a significant, if not profound, and ultimately essential alternative to immunizations as a way of addressing an infectious disease. I'm a little more skeptical of how easily and quickly we can get decision makers to hear and act on that information. But the starting point is to put it in front of them, and that's what
Right. You
know, I've done here with this report.
Right, and we're so grateful. Everyone is grateful for you for actually taking the time to write these affidavits and send them in and get them in front on the desks of people who can make big decisions. And I guess I keep wondering, do they even understand what is being spoken to them? And is this the very first time they're hearing this information, or is, you know, if they hear it enough times, will they turn their heads so that they'll actually pay attention to it and try to integrate it into their thinking? And that's kind of what I'm doing, because, you know, sometimes in life we're all just so overwhelmed with many personal issues, life issues, family and work, that adding something new into it is just not going to happen. And I think that's kind of what you're doing, is you're introducing these new concepts which are against the fray of what people have normally believed. You know, vaccinations are good, and it's difficult for people to change their thinking or to look at an oppositional viewpoint. That's all I'm saying.
Well, I think the question with regard to state legislators is probably ultimately not much different than the question with regard to anyone else in the general population. There are going to be some legislators who have some predisposition to being able to hear this. They already are fans of alternative health and complementary medicine or some other basis, will be receptive to it, and some won't. You know, the question is, how do we educate legislators and others alike, how do we get people to hear what we have to say? Because so many people who are steeped in mainstream views, the mere suggestion of an alternative view is dismissed just because it's not mainstream. You don't even get to the point where you have a meaningful conversation about what is your information, what is your evidence, what is your support for your point of view. But
right.
we're not going to get there unless we start putting it out. So, you know, as to how it falls on any given individual's ears, legislator or otherwise, who knows? But we put the information together. I think it's really hard, because there are some folks who would have said, Alan, don't even put that homeoprophylaxis thing in there. That's going to discredit the whole thing. There probably are people who would, with a legitimate basis to it, have that concern. But this particular instance with 2.5 million people is just profound. It's really hard to write that off. And in fact, if someone tries to say, well, homeopathy doesn't work, and then the conclusion we have to come to in Cuba then is that, okay, well, by doing something that didn't work, which would be saying we did the same thing as doing nothing, we actually were profoundly better off than we were when we were immunizing all those years before then. So let's just not do anything. Obviously, the vaccines are counterproductive.
Oh, my gosh. That is really incredible. That's an incredible way to look at it. So we have only a few minutes left. And so basically what we did was we got through point number 4, and next session radio show we'll do conflicts of interest, raise serious questions about vaccine policy. So let's just talk a little bit. I mean, for those people who are new to the show, they don't really know you. I didn't do my typical intro that you, Alan Phillips, you are a leading vaccine rights attorney, and that you advise individuals, families, other attorneys, groups, and organizations throughout the U.S. on vaccine exemptions and waiver rights. And you also support the legislative initiatives aimed at expanding vaccine freedom of choice. You have many publications. You're on lots of radio shows, on lots of boards. And what you have provided for the community, the international and, well, really the United States community specifically, is your ebook that provides all of the facts and information to have at their fingertips. And then if they have some specific individualized needs and concerns, they can contact you personally. But the main idea of doing this show is not only awareness and education as the first step, but actually action. And maybe tell us a little bit about the advocacy portal and the pandemic response. We have about 1 minute. Can you do that in 1 minute?
I'll do my best, and you stop me when I reach the end of the time. The whole vaccine controversy can be kind of put into two different components. The first one is awareness. It's critical. It's essential. It's a prerequisite. But awareness alone doesn't fix anything. So we have to become active. And where the rubber meets the road, where our rights are defined, first and foremost, are in the statutes, state and federal statutes, that say when you can and when you can't say no to vaccines. And so it's critical that we become legislatively active. And I encourage everyone who hasn't already done this to go to the NVIC.org, National Vaccine Information Center, NVIC.org, and click on the advocacy portal link on that site. Sign up for the advocacy portal. That's a incredibly wonderful website that enables people to follow, keep up with legislation in their state, aimed at either expanding or contracting vaccine rights. There's legislation to support and legislation to oppose. And the advocacy portal makes it easy for folks to be up to speed and to be involved.
Okay, super. We're going to close the show. We are going to listen to Alan sing us out. He's incredible as a musician as well as a lawyer and a legal expert. So bye-bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brook on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Your truth.